Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump expressed deep sympathy Tuesday night for the hundreds of thousands of Americans affected by the unchecked coronavirus pandemic here in the country, a marked contrast from her husband, President Donald Trump, who often has dismissed the impact of the infectious disease and said it will disappear. Speaking on the second night of the Republican National Convention, the First Lady extended her gratitude to healthcare workers who have treated millions of people who have contracted COVID-19. The pandemic has killed more than 178,000 people here in the U.S. and infected more than 5.7 million more, with both of those figures the highest for any country across the globe. But President Trump's handling of the crisis has been uneven, threatening his reelection chances on November 3rd against Democrat Joe Biden, with him dismissing its danger early in the year and saying it would soon disappear. Trump has touted unproven remedies, promised the vaccine as a preventative measure, and sooner, saying that experts will say to be the case for the vaccine, months refusing to wear a mask in public and saying he did not see it for himself. Other speakers voicing support for the president included Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was prompted a controversy by speaking to the Republican convention on Trump's behalf from Israel while on his diplomatic mission to the Jewish state. Typically, the U.S. diplomat has not played a role in U.S. elections and has been viewed as apolitical, representing the U.S. and overseas relations rather than the political party of the president who appointed him or her. A handful of Democrats have criticized Pompeo for breaking the tradition of staying out of the presidential race. For more news, join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The father of Jacob Blake, the U.S. black man who was shot Sunday by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, said his son is paralyzed from the waist down. He was shot in the back by police following a confrontation with officers. Police have said little about the incident, commenting only that they were responding to a domestic dispute. The shooting was captured on cell phone video and led to two nights of unrest in the southeastern Wisconsin city located between Milwaukee and Chicago. Protesters led by Black Lives Matter activists planned to march on Tuesday. The shooting occurred nearly 3 months after the May 25th death of a black man in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of George Floyd sparked nationwide protests against perceived police brutality and racism. The sentencing hearing for the New Zealand mosque shooter resumed for a third day in Christchurch on Wednesday. The Australian white supremacist Brenton Harrison Tarrant killed 51 worshippers at two mosques during the March 2019 attacks. Tarrant pleaded guilty back in March to 51 counts of murder and the 40 counts of attempted murder and one count of terrorism, the first terrorism conviction in New Zealand's history. Could become the first person in the country to be sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, the toughest sentence available. And Pakistan said Tuesday it was hopeful about prospects of U.S.-backed peace talks between Afghanistan's warring parties to end the country's long conflict. The optimism stemmed from a meeting by the Pakistani foreign minister and the Afghan Taliban delegation on Tuesday. The proposed talks are the product of the February 29th landmark peace deal the U.S. signed with the Taliban to help end decades of the Afghan violence and allow all U.S. troops to withdraw from the country by the middle of next year. The deal called for the Taliban to free 1,000 Afghan security forces they held captive. In exchange, the Afghan government was supposed to release up to 5,000 insurgent prisoners. While the Taliban has already released in phases all the detainees since the swap began in April, Kabul has freed all but 320 Taliban prisoners. Afghan officials have cited security concerns and pressure from the foreign governments for not setting the remaining prisoners free. The detainees they maintain are involved in deadly attacks against Afghans and citizens from other countries. And a Jamaican Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt self-quarantining at home after testing positive for the coronavirus. For more news, please join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Putty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's Electoral Commission approves candidates for October election.
The National Electoral Commission has officially nominated me and my running mate as presidential and vice presidential candidates for this year's general elections.
Zambia's health minister is acquitted of corruption charges. Women and child rights advocates in Liberia protest against rape. Cameroon dispatches humanitarian assistance as floods render thousands homeless. Ivory Coast Justice Minister responds to Amnesty International allegations. And the World Health Organization declares Africa polio-free.
We need to heighten surveillance in all our countries. We need to improve on immunization coverage, because it's important that we bring up the population immunity.
And a new study says West Africa teachers are paid less than other professionals. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tanzania's Electoral Commission on Tuesday approved the candidacy of President John Magufuli and his running mate Samia Suluhu Hassan to contest the October 28 election. The nomination papers of main opposition Chadema presidential candidate Tundu Lissu were also approved. However, Lissu on Tuesday called VOA to complain about delay in granting his papers, as well as armed security people who, he said, were stationed near the offices of the National Electoral Commission and were to arrest and take him into custody. For now, Lissu said he is ready to take on President Magufuli in October unless there is a challenge to his candidacy as required by Tanzania election laws.
That's right, Mr. Bhatti. The National Electoral Commission has officially nominated me and my running mate as presidential and vice presidential candidates for this year's general elections.
What do you mean pending any challenge to your candidacy? What does that mean?
Our election laws allow candidates and other persons to object to a particular candidate's candidacy within 24 hours of being nominated by the commission. So there is a period of 24 hours from the time of my nomination a short while ago within which any other candidate may enter an objection against me or my running mate.
We spoke with you earlier from the Elections Commission's offices, and you were concerned about the possibility that you could be arrested. What happened then?
Basically, after the news was circulated on social media, the three vehicles which we were told had people who wanted to take me out of town, they drove away. However, after I was cleared by the commission on our way out, they returned again, those three vehicles with unknown people inside. We are told they are likely to be intelligence operatives. But our members or supporters who were at the commission prevented them from blocking my route.
You are the presidential candidate for Chadema, the largest opposition party there. Is that a good thing for the possibility of an arrest or an objection to your candidacy hanging over your head as you prepare for the election?
Well, the fact that I'm a candidate now is a very good thing. First of all, it entitles me to official protection. Right now, I don't have any protection from the law enforcement agencies, but since I have now been declared a candidate, I'm entitled to official protection. Now, what the law says may not be what happens in practice in Tanzania, but I hope that the nomination today adds a measure of visibility and therefore security. I truly hope that the law enforcement agencies concerned will provide me with official protection as required by our statutes.
Mr. Lissu, the last time we talked, you had a court date and you have said that you will show up at the court. Were you able to go to the court or it hasn't happened yet?
Well, the court date is tomorrow morning. Actually, my plan was to file my nomination papers, see to it that I deal with any objections as they are filed, and rush to Dar es Salaam to appear in court. But if I'm being hunted like a criminal like this, then I fear for my security and I wouldn't want to get out to leave this building unless my security is assured.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bhatti.
Tundu Lissu is the presidential candidate for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party. You are speaking with us from the capital, Dodoma. A magistrate in Zambia Tuesday acquitted Zambian Health Minister Chitalu Chilufya on four charges of alleged corruption brought against him by the country's anti-corruption commission, the ACC. Magistrate Lamek Mwale acquitted the minister after ACC Acting Director General Rosemary Kuzwayo did not show up in court on Tuesday, reportedly due to illness. One of the ACC lawyers told the magistrate that he was instructed not to give further evidence in the case. Some on Zambian social media platforms wanted to know who gave the instructions not to provide further evidence and whether that was enough to acquit the health minister. Tutua Ngulube is the lawyer for Health Minister Chilufya.
Yes, I think the minister is very happy with the outcome of the proceedings because he believed that the proceedings should not have been commenced in the first place because he did articulate his issues very well with them when they called him for several interviews. And it was shocking that even when there was nothing because the crime, they insisted that the public must actually see them to be working when in actual fact there is nothing. So the whole set of allegations started when they claimed that he had benefited from the supply of ambulances which were supplied to the government of Zambia. And they were accusing him that he was a beneficiary of corrupt monies. So they went on and did their investigations and found that there was no evidence linking him to any of those ambulances. Because as far as we are concerned, the issue of the ambulances could not even have been any of the issues to be tried in court. Because one, he's not involved in any government procurement. Number two, he does not even sit on the procurement committee. Number three, the ambulances were delivered to the government of Zambia and not to him. And they were fully paid for and, you know, they were working. They shifted the allegations from saying you corruptly benefited from the ambulances. And then now they started talking about you have so much property. You know, you own too many properties around Lusaka and all these other areas.
The WHO the other day issued a warning about corruption pertaining to COVID-19 funds. I'm sure this must have been of concern to the health minister.
Yes, of course. The health minister has been very, very worried that people are not taking the issues of coronavirus very seriously. And I think if you heard a few weeks ago, the vice president was warning Minister of Health officials in all the 10 provinces to account for all the donations made to the fight against COVID-19. The issues of allegations that the minister was facing related to business transactions that his company was involved in. For example, 4 years ago, one of his companies entered into an agreement to purchase a boat through another agent. The boat was bought from Dubai through an importing company, and they said that, you see, he had corruptly acquired the boat. There was no evidence to that effect. Secondly, they said that he had possessed a $200,000. There was no evidence about that. No one actually saw it, and it never existed. The third allegation related to the shares that he bought in a company that he had actually an interest in. And again, there was no evidence that the monies were actually proceeds of crime. When the Anti-Corruption Commission did their investigations, they found that the total number of shares that he purchased only amounted to 10,000 shares. And all the allegations put together only amounted to about 5 million kwacha, which we can simply say is in the range of maybe $30,000 or $35,000, $300,000, so to speak, in total. When they analyzed his earnings as a member of parliament, they found that his earnings as a member of parliament were far much more than what he's alleged to have corruptly obtained.
Tutua Ngulube is a member of Zambia's parliament and the lawyer for Health Minister Chitalu Chilufya. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. The World Health Organization has declared Africa free of the wild polio virus. The last case of the crippling disease was detected in 2016 in Nigeria. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
Health officials are celebrating a momentous milestone. They are marking only the second eradication of a virus from the African continent since smallpox was wiped out 40 years ago. The journey toward this historic achievement began in 1996 when African heads of state committed to eradicate polio. That same year, South African President Nelson Mandela and service organization Rotary International launched a Kick Polio Out of Africa campaign. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, calls it a game changer. Over the past 24 years, she says polio eradication efforts have prevented up to 1.8 million children from suffering from the disease's crippling lifelong paralysis and saved some 180,000 lives. Now, she says, future generations of African children can live free of wild polio. She says it is time to finish polio once and for all by accelerating action toward global polio eradication. She says the threat of circulating vaccine-derived polio viruses must be stopped.
Currently, 16 African countries are responding to outbreaks of vaccine-derived polio viruses, which are a less common form of polio that affects populations where there is poor sanitation and low immunization coverage. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted the response to some of these outbreaks with the suspension of vaccination campaigns.
Moeti says she is confident the problem will be overcome. The Independent African Regional Certification Commission considered Africa polio-free after the continent passed four successive years without any detectable cases of the disease. The chair of the commission, Rose Leke, says Cameroon, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Nigeria were the last four countries to receive the wild polio-free status. Despite the good news, she says, countries will have to continue to be careful and not let down their guard. She says surveillance will have to be heightened and vaccination rates will have to be kept up to avert a resurgence of the wild polio virus.
There are still two countries in the world, Afghanistan and Pakistan, that are still harboring the transmission of the wild polio virus. So we can have importations at any time. So we need to heighten surveillance in all our countries. We need to improve on immunization coverage because it's important that we bring up the population immunity.
Leke says the wild polio virus does not respect borders. Until polio is wiped off the face of the earth, she says people will remain vulnerable to the crippling disease. She says countries will have to stay vigilant to maintain and sustain all the gains that have been made. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 26th. Cameroon has dispatched emergency aid for at least 5,000 people left homeless or displaced by the worst coastal flooding in decades. Heavy rains this month swept floodwaters through Douala, Cameroon's largest city and economic capital, leaving much of it underwater. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
39-year-old fresh fish seller Maslin Obono says she lost all of her fish in weekend floods in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala. She says she obtained a loan from a friend to buy fish and sell at the Nkululun market, but that she is not certain of what may happen as more heavy rain is threatening to fall. She says she is very, very worried because her children who are back at home may not be safe if there is a heavy downpour. She says God saved her house from collapsing during last weekend's heavy downpour that flooded almost all of her neighborhood. The government of Cameroon reports that more than 5,000 people are either homeless or have left their homes temporarily to seek refuge in safer areas of the town. neighborhoods like Bepanda, Safari, Aqua, New Bell, Kululun, Bongo City, Verge, Makepe, Misoke, Karia de Tet, Mabanda, Bonaberry, Bepanda, Bongo, Bona Musadi were the hardest hit. Many houses were completely covered by the floods. Six bridges, including the one linking the city of Douala and the Douala International Airport, collapsed. Thousands of goats, sheep, and fowls were dumped by the floods on the Atlantic Ocean. No human deaths were reported. Celestine Kecha-Kutes, Cameroon's Minister of Housing and Urban Development, says failure by citizens to respect the city's urbanization plan provoked the floods. She says Cameroon President Paul Biya asked her to visit Douala and tell residents that he is unhappy with uncivil behavior that exposed civilians to floods. Paul Atanganji, Cameroon Territorial Administration Minister, says he was also dispatched by Biya to hand humanitarian assistance to victims of the floods. He says people should stop constructing houses in forbidden areas.
We have come here to assist victims of the flood. We have to ask the local population to work hand in hand with the local administrative authorities and with the government. When the local administrative authorities tell you that you should not build in swampy areas, you have to follow them, because we are defending your own rights. If you go and invest in a swampy area, you lose your investment.
G handed to the victims food items, blankets, mattresses, and first aid drugs. The last time floods of a similar magnitude hit Douala was 7 years ago. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Hundreds of young campaigners took to the streets of the Liberian capital, Monrovia, on Tuesday, calling on the government of President George Weah to declare rape as a national emergency. As Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia, the protesters say they will remain in the streets for the next 3 days.
Were young men singing songs of solidarity as they march up to Capitol Hill, the seat of the Liberian government. Titus Pakala is the leader and lead campaigner for the March for Justice.
We are asking the government today to declare rape a national emergency. We are asking the government today to decentralize criminal code E in all of the counties, in making sure that rape-related cases are fairly adjudicated. So we have so many recommendations to the government, but amongst them is declaring rape a national emergency.
Records shows that in the last 7 months, there have been over 900 rape cases in Liberia, something the protesters said elevates rape to epidemic status in Liberia. Benita Yure, a famous Liberian blogger, was one of the marchers.
Rape is at an alarming rise in Liberia, even more than the coronavirus. We started following up and found out that within 7 months, we've had 958 confirmed cases. That does not include the cases that have been compromised.
In Liberia, those convicted of rape charges spend from 5 years to life imprisonment, but that doesn't seem to have an impact on the culture of rape in the country. President of the Federation of Liberian Youth, Amos Williams, said he wants a tougher punishment for rape perpetrators.
We're also calling and asking that we look at the issue of the penalty, that perpetrators who are caught in the crime, we need some harsh penalty to that. We need to ensure that they go through some harsh penalty.
These were some of the slogans accompanied by face painting and placards carrying anti-rape campaign messages. Award-winning Liberian singer Maurice Givler, commonly called CIC, was also among the protesters. He said the protest was another way of fighting for the women and children of Liberia.
The numbers are getting higher day by day, so if we don't stay in the gap and fight it, nobody will fight for our sisters. And I believe they don't have the strength to fight for themselves right now, so we have to stay in the gap for them. I come not as CIC, but as a Liberian citizen as well, who is against rape and is saying no to rape, and the government must take a stand.
The protesters were expected to present petitions to the legislature and President George Weah, but the president was not immediately available. Instead, the protesters turned his general minister away. Patience Courtier had this message for President Weah.
We thank you for coming, we recommend you, but we demand that our president, the feminist in chief, Amanda! This is no form of disrespect, it's just our protocol, and this is what we need. young people.
However, members of the legislature were on hand to receive that petition from the young protesters. 14-year-old Ari Smith read and presented a petition to the legislature.
Honorable members of the legislature, we have a rape pandemic on our hands. There has been hundreds of rape cases across the country, and the numbers keep climbing. These outrages are our only persisting because our justice system has been so weak.
Receiving a petition, Lofa County Representative Judy Fatoma Wia lauded the peaceful nature of the gathering and said she was in solidarity.
We want to make sure that we take this to our colleague. The full plenary will discuss this and arrange a public hearing, and we'll make sure that you people will be part of this hearing. And we want to work together to make sure that we put this in place. Like she said, enough is enough.
The protesters say they will remain in the streets for the next 3 days until President Wia's government yield to their demand to declare rape as a national emergency in the country. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
Ivory Coast Justice Minister has refuted claims by Amnesty International that Abidjan police collaborated with a group of men, some of whom were armed with machetes and large sticks, to attack demonstrators. In a statement, Justice Minister Aimé Zibeyu described the allegations as unfounded. He said the police acted in compliance with established laws and regulations governing protests. Journalist Felix Boni is in Abidjan.
The Justice Minister said what has been said about the security situation is not all right. But normally it is right, because Amnesty International in Cote d'Ivoire knows the reality, and everyone saw what's happened this week with the opposition manifestation. And I know the government is trying to justify himself, and it is not good because they are not telling the truth. That's why in Cote d'Ivoire, we don't know what the next week will be, because we are not sure that the situation will be peaceful before the date of the election.
The government said it remains respectful of human rights, in particular freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, and freedom of assembly, which it said are guaranteed in the Ivorian constitution.
You know, it's not only the policemen who try to face the demonstrators, because we have some young boys called in Cote d'Ivoire microbes who were committed to make a kind of security to impeach the demonstrator to continue the demonstration. And it create a lot of crimes. A lot of people died in this situation, and a lot of damage has been caused. It is not false. It is true. Everyone has seen the movies of this demonstration and of the consequences of this demonstration. So the government cannot denounce the situation that is the evidence for everyone living in Cote d'Ivoire.
Felix, the elections are coming up, and President Ouattara just last week submitted his papers for a register. Now, how organized do you think the opposition people?
I know that Mr. Bédié will also register himself this week. And I don't think the opposition will have a lot of candidates, because most of the leaders of opposition have not been able to gather the required percentages for the sponsorship before the election. I know that Mr. Bédié is really ready, and certainly he will be the candidate of all the opposition face to Mr. Ouattara. This is the reality at this moment. We are waiting before next Sunday for the rest of the opposition to register themselves.
United States is appealing to the ruling party, the government, the opposition, and civil society to ensure that the elections are peaceful. Given what's happening in Mali, Guinea, what are the prospects that the elections, if they are held in Cote d'Ivoire, they will be peaceful?
You know, the condition of a peaceful election are not gathered in Cote d'Ivoire, and the situation in Mali inspired most of Ivorian, even militarist members, and we don't know what tomorrow will be. I said at the beginning, the situation in Cote d'Ivoire is very difficult at this moment. It is a precarious situation, and we don't know what will happen.
That was journalist Felix Boni speaking with us from Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. And that's it for this Wednesday, August 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.